And it is just this difference that separates Negroes from what Fuller calls democratic thinking people. Negroes want freedom now, and democratic thinking people want Negroes to have it later. The only way Negroes can prevent separation from the liberals on this issue is to give in to them and to let them decide when and where and how much freedom Negroes shall have. And that's what Alex Fuller and the other Negro leaders have done. That's what they want Negroes, the Negro people, to do or keep on doing. But the Freedom Now Party has decided that 100 years of political subservience is enough. They have made their declaration of political independence. And they are striking out on their own, determined to use their political power for themselves, first, last, and all the time. Now, before proceeding to our examination from a Marxist point of view of how much and not how little a minority can do, I should already have made clear before this, that I am not talking about just any minority, but about a minority with certain characteristics, certain features, and a certain history. And also, yes, I am talking about a minority of a certain size, too. So let me get the question of size out of the way first. Obviously, not every minority is big enough to do the things I am going to talk about. Size is important, too. If there were only 2 or 3 million Negroes in this country, which is approaching a population of 200 million, they could not accomplish what a minority of 20 million can accomplish. But 20 million is a big force, big enough to tear things up, big enough and weighty enough so that what it does can appreciably affect other forces. After all, how many nations in the United Nations, not only the new ones in Africa and Asia, but also the old ones in Europe and the Americas, how many of these nations have a population of 20 million? I made a fast survey yesterday, and I found that in the United Nations, which has over 100 countries represented, only 20 of those nations have more than 20 million people, and that therefore more than four-fifths of the countries represented in the United Nations are smaller in population than the Negro people of the United States. Now, what are the other characteristics besides size of the kind of minority that we are talking about here? Because size and relative weight are not the only important factors to be considered. For example, a minority of even 40 million cannot accomplish much by itself if it is, or as long as it is, satisfied and contented with its conditions, or indifferent and apathetic about them. As important as size, or more important in deciding what a minority can do, are social, economic, political, historical, and psychological factors. In other words, what a minority can do depends on whether or not it is oppressed and exploited because of some minority trait or feature, is separated out by society for special inferior treatment, is denied equal treatment, opportunity, and status. Whether or not it is at the bottom of the social structure, so that when it rises, it shakes the whole setup. Whether or not it is condemned to live under conditions worse than the rest of society. Whether or not it is part of the most productive and progressive force in the modern world, the working class, and yet at the same time is denied the full benefits of membership in that class. Whether or not it exists not only in an oppressive and exploitive society, but in an oppressive and exploitive society in deep crisis, challenged on all sides by change, and therefore no longer stable and able to maintain the status quo, however hard its rulers try to maintain it. Whether or not this minority believes it can take advantage of this crisis of society, is affected by and responds to the great tides of change and revolution sweeping the world, has a sense of kinship and solidarity with the masses changing the rest of the world. Whether or not it has the consciousness of being an oppressed minority with common interests, can be knitted together for common action and goals, whether or not it is compact and contiguous geographically so that it can act with maximum cohesiveness and impact, whether or not it has learned to see through the brainwashing which the ruling class uses to keep this minority in its place, whether or not it realizes it has never made any gains except by fighting for them, whether it has lost patience with the majority and has lost respect for it, sees no further reason to believe in gradualism, is freeing itself from the influence of conservative leaders who have always held them back, and shows the capacity to produce new militant and revolutionary leaders, whether or not it has special privileges to make it conservative or cautious, whether or not it feels it has nothing to lose but its chains, whether or not it has the capacity to defend itself against terror and violence, whether or not it is developing a militant ideology and philosophy and methodology of its own that can motivate and spark sustained and audacious and independent struggle. In short, I am talking about the characteristics that fit the American Negro people, or which the Negro people are in the process of acquiring at an extremely rapid rate, and which are impelling them toward the kind of action that will make possible the full utilization of the maximum potential of this kind of minority. And here are some of the things such a minority can do, not necessarily in the order of their importance. One, it can force serious concessions from the ruling class. It cannot, as long as the capitalist class is in power, win full and unconditional equality, because that is incompatible with the present social system, which rests on the basis of inequality. But it can force the present ruling class to lift some of the existing racial restrictions and barriers in the form of more rights, more jobs, better schools, better housing, less police brutality, and a greater measure of formal equality before the law. Negroes will not settle for such partial gains and concessions, but they would be fools not to fight for them and take them and utilize them to press for more and more fundamental changes. Two, a minority properly oriented and led can go much, much further than it has gone so far to make the present system unworkable and intolerable as a way of winning their own equality. Some people call this the strategy of social dislocation. Reverend Clegg of Detroit has called it a strategy of chaos and has called for it. Others call it by the name of mass civil disobedience. Whatever you call it, it has barely been tried in practice in America up to now. It consists of making the system so expensive and so inconvenient that white people are forced to ask themselves whether it is worthwhile and whether they should not, in their own interests, help to reform or do away with it altogether. It means lying down, interposing your bodies on the airplane runways, on the expressways, at the plant gates, at the school entrances, at the point of production and the point of distribution and the point of transportation, and attempting to throw a monkey wrench into the wheels of the system to paralyze it, to bring it to a stop. It means saying, if we can't have decent and equal schools, And let's not have any schools. If we can't have jobs and job equality, then let no one be able to work. If we can't vote, then let nobody be able to vote. If we can't belong to the unions as equals, then we don't care what happens to the unions. It means carrying the principle of the sit-down strike, which stopped production, much further and into entirely new areas of social life. I say this has been barely tried as a full-scale weapon of the Negro minority, but I have no doubt that it will be in increasing scope. Already some members of SNCC have projected such action and have had it rejected by the moderate leaders like Reverend King, who talks about civil disobedience but is mortally afraid of really unleashing it on a mass scale and without restriction. The sit-ins, the lie-ins, the wait-ins, etc., were just the faint and small and exploratory versions of what is still to come in a giant size and to the accompaniment of deep social convulsions and conflict. To avoid misunderstanding, let me just say that what I am talking about here is not pacifism, but an all-out struggle, which, when it reaches full flower, will be the equivalent of a general strike. And a general strike usually tends to lead to the posing of the question of who shall have the power in the land. 3. A minority can, merely by carrying through its fight for democratic rights without compromise, help to educate and radicalize the American people, especially the youth in whose hands the future lies. In fact, it is already doing so. You in this audience of young socialists and young radicals know better than anybody else how profoundly your thinking about the whole world has been influenced by the Negro struggle, perhaps even before you were in direct contact with it. How your general ideas about capitalism and socialism, about the myths you were taught about bourgeois democracy and the free world, were clarified or formed or dispelled by the elementary struggle of the Negroes. Not only the Cuban Revolution, not only the danger of atomic war, but something much closer to home, the Negro Revolt, and often this was the first factor, have helped to educate you and radicalize you and get you to dedicate your lives to the struggle for a better world. There can be no doubt that in this respect you were not so much unique as early, and that the deepening struggle of the Negro minority will have similar repercussions on other young people and on some of the not completely hopeless older people as well. 4. A minority can not only educate other forces, but set them into motion too. It can stimulate them to fight for their own needs and interests through the power of example as well as the power of pressure. A small illustration of the power of example you've already heard about was the reference by Comrade Vernon to the rent strike, which began among Negroes in Harlem and now is spreading to other sections of the population in other parts of the city. Some of you may remember the cases concerning police brutality in Detroit last summer, which was written about in our press, where Negroes staged a militant demonstration in front of the police headquarters on a Saturday afternoon because the police had shot a young Negro woman in the back, and how only 2 days later a group of young white people staged an even more militant demonstration because they were throwing rocks at the cops instead of just calling them names because the cops had shot a young white man in the back. More recently, I noticed a little item in the newspapers about some airline pickets outside of the Newark terminal who had been picketing up and down outside for a long, long time, and then who one day suddenly decided to go into the terminal, which it was prohibited, and to sit down there. And they were quickly arrested and asked what was going on. And they said, well, they had seen that the Negroes were able to get action by sit-ins and by going places where they weren't supposed to, so they thought that it was a good idea and they would imitate them. Can anyone doubt, to give another example, that if unemployed Negroes win jobs by demonstrations that force the government to start new public works projects, that unemployed whites will not be certain to follow suit and stage demonstrations of their own so that they can win jobs too? 5. A determined minority, and this is most important, can also divide the majority, can split it at decisive moments and junctures, thereby greatly reducing the disadvantages of being a minority and changing the odds from unfavorable to favorable sometimes. Elsewhere and in our resolutions, we have shown how this process has operated historically. The clearest example was in the fight against slavery. The Civil War was not just a conflict between abstract forces, between Northern capitalism and Southern slavery. It was also a struggle between classes and living people. And in this, the role of the slaves and ex-slaves was crucial. Again and again in the 3 or 4 decades before the Civil War, the North and the South decided to compromise over the slave question and thus avoid any sharp showdown. But the slaves who were not consulted about these great compromises did not consent to them. They continued their own independent struggles and resistance through insurrections, sabotage, passive resistance, and mass escapes by the Underground Railway, just as if these great compromises had not been enacted into law. And these independent actions of the slaves prevented the compromises from working. They reopened and sharpened the breach between the South and the North every time the great compromise statesmen tried to close it. They drove a wedge between the slaveholders and those who tried to compromise with the slaveholders, and kept on widening the breach. That, above everything else, the bold action of those slaves is what made the struggle become irrepressible and the breach ungappable and the division among the whites insoluble except through resort to civil warfare. And then the Negroes, at the crucial moment when the war began, pressured the Northern government into accepting a revolutionary emancipation policy and completed the process by providing what the reluctant Lincoln later admitted was the military balance of power. We can be certain that the Negro struggle for equality in our own time can have a similarly divisive effect on the white majority. The majority is not homogeneous anyway. It is torn and divided and in conflict over 1,000 questions of policy and interest. A skillful Negro minority will know how to pick the right place to drive new wedges, to deepen differences among the whites, to sharpen their conflicts, to set them fighting each other. And in the process, as our 1963 convention resolution says, to find alliances with those forces and classes whose interests are closer to the Negroes against those forces who are most hostile to the Negroes. 6. A Negro minority is also in a position to upset the whole political structure of this country, and to do it anyway, to start it, by going it alone. Alone. By what the Negroes themselves decide to do with their own votes and their own minority political strength. We have dealt with this in our convention resolution too, but it bears restatement because it is such an effective refutation of the Kings and Randolphs and Wilkins who say Negroes cannot go it alone in politics because it means certain isolation and defeat. Negroes can form their own party. Negroes can run their own candidates. Negroes, because they're already a majority in many districts, thanks to the segregated housing system, can elect dozens of candidates to Congress from these districts and hundreds of state and local representatives, and thus can have representatives responsible and accountable to the Negro community instead of to the major party machines, and through them can hold and wield a certain legislative balance of power and force real concessions from the power structure instead of just tokens and crumbs. All of this, you notice, without any drastic change in political relations, just by refusing to vote Democratic or Republican, and by voting black and taking advantage of conditions created by segregation. This will mark a real advance, at least in the degree and quality of Negro representation in politics. But that's only a part of the result of going it alone in politics. By forming their own party, Negroes can paralyze the Democratic Party and rock the whole political structure to its foundations. Without their votes, the bell will toll the doom of the Democratic Party. Without their votes, the Democratic coalition with the labor movement will be undermined and destroyed. Without their votes, the unions will be forced to reconsider their whole political orientation, and that will give encouragement to the pro-labor party forces among them, and eventually will lead to the creation of a new labor party. Without their votes, the present two-party system will pass from the scene and be replaced by something new, out of which Negroes may be able to acquire new and more reliable allies than ever before. And all of this can be accomplished by the simple device of forming a Negro party and running Negro candidates. Really, you can almost pity the ignorance of the Negro leaders who preach that Negroes can do nothing by going it alone in politics. 7. Time prevents me from discussing any but one more thing that a minority can do. And this one I'd like you to listen to carefully because it's the most important one. And that is that the Negro people, although a minority, can with a proper, that is a consistently revolutionary leadership, lead the American working class or socialist revolution. Let me repeat that. The Negro minority can lead the American workers' revolution that will abolish capitalism. To grasp this profoundly crucial idea, we must rid our minds of the conception that any social revolution in general, or any working class revolution in particular, has to be led by a majority. Let me illustrate what I mean by going back to the Russian Revolution of 1917. That, as you know, was the first victorious workers' revolution in history. Its victory was possible because it had the support of a majority of the Russian people. But it was not led by any class or by any vanguard of a class that represented the majority of the Russian people. It was a revolution supported by the majority and couldn't have succeeded without that majority support. But it was led by a party that represented a class that was a small minority of the country. It was a working class revolution. But out of 150 million people in Russia in 1917, the workers were a small minority. I hope some students here will check the exact figures, which I wasn't able to locate in the last minute preparation of these remarks. What I found were some figures in Trotsky's History of the Russian Revolution. He estimated that there were at most 10 million workers in Russia out of 150 million people, 10 million workers. And in this, he included agricultural workers. many of whom were only workers part of the time. So the number of industrial workers must have been much smaller than 10 million out of 150 million. Maybe not much more than 5 million out of 150 million. Yet this class, with the proper leadership in the form of Lenin's Bolshevik Party, was able to lead a revolution that abolished capitalism in Russia. This is one of the things that threw the Mensheviks, the Social Democrats, and the other white liberals of that day into confusion, as they understood Marx's predictions, about social revolution. It could not take place and should not even be attempted until the country was industrialized to the point where the working class was a majority of the population, as in England then or as in the United States today. And if it was attempted before then, before the working class was a majority of the population, it was bound to fail, according to these people. And they were so sure that the Russian Revolution was not according to either Hoyle or Marx that most of them did what they could to make it fail. But they misunderstood Marx and Marxism, as fortunately Lenin and Trotsky and others did not. A socialist revolution can be led by the working class even when the working class is a minority, provided that working class minority can get an alliance with and support from the other non-capitalist forces and classes in the country. In Russia, this meant that the peasantry, who constituted, I don't remember, and I wish again somebody would check and supply these figures, this meant an alliance with the peasantry who constituted, let's say, around 80 or 90% of the country. The working class minority was able to lead the Russian Revolution because it seized the advantages resulting from the crisis of the capitalist class in the war, determined that the revolution could and should be made, and worked out an alliance with the most oppressed sections of the peasantry. Worked out an alliance based on common interests of workers and peasants, without making any concessions to the peasants about the need to end capitalism, and offered to satisfy their most pressing needs, but this alliance was based on the needs and interests of the working class minority first of all, because the workers were the backbone of the revolution and the most revolutionary force in Russia. Now, why, in discussing the American Revolution of the 1960s and 1970s, have I gone all the way back to 1917 and far off Russia? Because I thought it would throw light on the distinction between making a revolution and leading a revolution, on the leading role that a minority can play, on how dogma can blind you to the leading role of a minority, and how successful leadership of a working class revolution by a minority class depends partly on the ability to make alliances with other exploited classes and groups. I'm not proving anything by this. I'm only trying to get us to look at the question of the role of revolutionary minorities in a fresh way. The working class revolution has to be led by workers through their party or parties or councils. That's one thing we learned from Marx. Marx did not say the working class revolution had to be led by white workers. He said only by workers, by the most revolutionary workers. Now, the Negroes in this country are a racial minority, but that's only one of their aspects. And it would be truly fatal to forget their other salient aspect, namely, that they are in their overwhelming majority a group that is proletarian in composition. In fact, Negroes are more proletarian than whites. And they are a section of the working class as a whole. And unless we are blind, they are at present, and will probably remain, the most radicalized and revolutionary section of the working class. The section of the working class that has the most to gain from social revolution and the least to lose. If this is true, and I maintain it's not only true but crucial for the future of the American Revolution, then why should it be hard to conceive of the possibility, when we are discussing what a radical minority of the working class can do, to conceive of the possibility that this minority may lead the rest of the working class and its allies in the revolution to abolish capitalism? As a matter of fact, that's just what Leon Trotsky, who did so much to educate us in Marxism, what Trotsky taught us when we were trying 25 years ago to work out a correct and revolutionary analysis of the Negro struggle. Things were a lot different in 1933, before the CIO, and in 1939, long before the current radicalization of the Negro people. But let me read you some things Trotsky tried to teach us then, and see if they do not apply with even greater validity and relevance to the changed conditions of our time. The documents that I'm going to read you from, a few sentences from, are collected in the Pioneer Publishers Bulletin, Documents of the Negro Struggle, which is on sale in the other room. I'm going to read first from a quotation of a discussion with Trotsky in 1933, 31 years ago, at the very depth of the Depression, before the CIO was formed. And the English is not too good, because that was not Trotsky's native tongue, but the ideas were. Let me read you. He's talking about what will happen when a radicalization begins in America. He says, "I believe that by the unheard of political and theoretical backwardness and the unheard of economic advance, the awakening of the working class will proceed quite rapidly once it begins. The old ideological covering will burst. All questions will emerge at once. And since the country is so economically mature, the adaptation of the political and theoretical to the economic level will be achieved very rapidly." And in other words, once the workers begin to move, he says, they may move very rapidly. "It is then possible," he continues, "that the Negroes will become the most advanced section." We've already a similar example in Russia. The Russians were the European Negroes. "It is very possible that the Negroes also, through the self-determination, will proceed to the proletarian dictatorship in a couple of gigantic strides ahead of the great block of white workers. They will then furnish the vanguard." They will then furnish the vanguard. "I am absolutely sure that they will, in any case, fight better than the white workers. That, however, can happen only provided the Communist Party," the small c, he would say the Socialist Workers' Party, "that, however, can happen only provided the Communist Party carries on an uncompromising, merciless struggle, not against the supposed national prepossessions of the Negroes, but against the colossal prejudices of the white workers, and gives it no concessions whatever." That's 1933. Now, 6 years later, 1939, Trotsky is talking with another group of Americans. And he said, "If the workers' aristocracy is the basis of opportunism, one of the sources of adaptation to capitalist society, then the most oppressed and discriminated against are the most dynamic milieu of the working class. We must say to the conscious elements of the Negroes that they are convoked by the historic development to become a vanguard of the working class. What serves as the brake on the higher strata? It is the privileges, the comforts, that hinder them from becoming revolutionists. It does not exist for the Negroes. What can transform a certain stratum, make it more capable of courage and sacrifice? It is concentrated in the Negroes. If it happens that we in the SWP are not able to find the road to this stratum, then we are not worthy at all. The permanent revolution and all the rest would be only a lie. Let me just repeat those three things. It is possible the Negroes will become the most advanced section. It is possible that the Negroes will proceed to proletarian dictatorship ahead of the great bloc of white workers. The Negroes are convoked by the historic development to become a vanguard of the working class. What Trotsky was trying to get us to understand, therefore, 25 and 30 years ago, was the possibility that the Negroes could lead the proletarian revolution. And this, our party, tried to understand and express in the very first resolution on the Negro struggle it ever adopted, in saying which, it was the first party to ever put this idea forward. And now I'll read just the first two sentences of that resolution, which was adopted at our 1939 convention. It goes as follows. The American Negroes, for centuries the most oppressed section of American society and the most discriminated against, are potentially the most revolutionary element of the population. They are designated by their whole historical past to be, under adequate leadership, the very vanguard of the proletarian revolution. So what I've been trying to say in the last of my incomplete list of things that a minority can do, that the black minority can lead the white majority of the working class in the coming social revolution, is not really new at all. Because we explicitly and plainly stated that concept in a formal party convention resolution in 1939, before most of the people in this hall were born. Then why does it seem new to many of us? Because, I am sorry to say, there is a gap, and it can be a big gap, between thinking or hearing or even saying something, accepting it in a general but cursory way as logically correct, between that and grasping a profound truth that flies in the face of all prevailing opinion and pervading prejudice, grasping it in all of its concreteness and relevance, and making it a part of you, of your blood and bone and gristle, and then guiding your action and your life in accordance with this truth. There's also a big difference between accepting a general possibility that may become true at some indefinite future time, and absorbing this possibility as perhaps even a probability right now or in the relatively close future. Because although in 1939 we accepted the idea that the Negro minority can lead the working class revolution and willingly adopted that as the official position of the Socialist Workers' Party, the truth is that it was only a surface acceptance and adoption, because we were not yet ready to fully understand what Trotsky was trying to teach us. And so, only 1.5 months after that 1939 convention voted for this idea and adopted this resolution, J.R. Johnson, the principal leader of our party's Negro work at that time, wrote in our paper, which was then called the Socialist Appeal, that while the idea was correct that Negroes would be in the forefront, that it was an overstatement. And it would have been more correct, he said, instead of saying the Negro people are designated to be the very vanguard, to say that they are designated to be in the very vanguard, which was a real weakening of the idea Trotsky had tried to persuade us of, even though it still left the SWP with the most advanced revolutionary position on the Negro struggle. But now, with Trotsky long dead, I think we are able to return to that original, unweakened idea and see it in an entirely different light, not as an overstatement, but as a cold, hard, factually correct appraisal of a vital possibility. Because what Trotsky could not teach us completely, we have now been able to learn from the actual development of the Negro struggle itself, right before our own eyes, these last 2 or 3 years. What we were not advanced enough to accept then as theory, we are now able to apprehend as concrete current event. Because the fact is that the Negroes are already a vanguard. They are already out in front of most white workers. They are more radicalized than the white workers. They are more ready to fight and sacrifice and die in order to change this system. And so today, many of us, I am sure, will be able to grasp and act on the concept of Negroes as leaders of the workers' revolution, not just as a possibility, but as a probability. I shall not try to complete everything that necessarily flows from this concept, except to say that much does, and that all of it is cause for optimism. I shall not try to delineate the kind of alliance that the Negro vanguard of the working class revolution will have to effect with the white workers if the working class revolution is to be led to success, except to say that it will not, cannot be, an alliance that will make concessions in principle to the white workers who will be the allies of the Negroes.
Any more than the
Bolshevik vanguard in Russia made unprincipled concessions to their peasant allies. Instead, I shall conclude, with much left hanging, by saying that if the ideas in this talk are correct, if the concepts about what a minority can do will prove of practical and theoretical benefit in promoting the Negro the struggle for freedom now, then what they demonstrate is the validity and even indispensability of Marxism to Negro revolutionists, whether or not they belong to the SWP. Because what they represent is an initial attempt, however crude and unpolished, to carry out what we called for in our 1963 resolution. That is, the Afro-Americanization of Marxism, by which we meant the application of Marxism to the specific conditions of the Negro people and the application of their experiences to further concretize and enrich Marxism as a tool of revolution.